Oh, well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Christchurch Art Gallery. My name is Jennifer Hay. I'm the curator of Observation, Action, Reflection, the selected survey exhibition of the sculptor Andrew Drummond. And it's my pleasure to introduce tonight's speaker, who is the artist himself, Andrew Drummond, and he'll be talking to you this evening about the development of technology in his practice. So if you'll all join me in welcoming Andrew. Thank you.
Well, thank you, and welcome. I'd like to say a few thank yous, actually, to start with, because it's the only time I'm going to do anything around the show, and there's a lot of stuff that's happened and more that is going to happen. And so I want to thank, of course, Jennifer Hay, who's the curator, who's worked on this for years, it seems, but the director, Jenny Harper, and all of the staff at the Art Gallery. And I tell you, like, the installation, when you wander through, is, well, from my point of view, it's pretty beautiful, but incredibly difficult to pull together, and they worked extraordinarily hard over 3 weeks. I mean, I can't believe that 3 weeks just disappeared, and it was all up, and it was all working. And some of it is a bit technically tricky, and we try and build things that last forever, but, you know, technology comes and haunts you sometimes. Anyway, I just want to thank the gallery for putting it on and doing a magnificent job of putting it on, and all of the things that go around an exhibition like this just amaze me. And then, even more amazing, the book, which is coming out in July. And I've been looking at some proofs today, and I went... you know, I just don't believe how amazing the quality of the publication is going to be. And the photographer, the new photographer at the gallery, who's just swept in and photographed the work so beautifully and sensitively. And then all of the writers, including Jennifer. And I'd like to mention the writers, because what I'm going to do tonight is not explain my work, because I don't think I could. And they've done an absolutely magnificent job of all taking apart me, the work, and putting it in some kind of context where people can sort of read it on, and understand why I've done what I've done. So I just want to mention the writers, and which is Jennifer Hay, of course, who's written the major essay. Bruce Barber, who's dealt with the performance, and he lives in Canada, and has done a wonderful job. He actually frightened me about what I did. John Finlay, who is from England but lives in New Zealand now, who's interviewed me. Peter Leach, an old friend from Dunedin, who's the professor of art theory and art history, who once again frightened me to death about what I was doing. And Pamela Hansford from Australia, who's talked about technology. And, of course, Jenny Harper and Justin Patton. So it's a lot of writing, but there's a lot of images, and it's going to be a magnificent publication. So I just wanted to, you know, thank everyone, for particularly the gallery and all these people who've sort of come around and made my life, given a focus to my life that I'd sort of had, but I didn't realise it was quite so encompassing. And, of course, didn't really think that I'd made that much work, and this is just a smidgen of what I've done. Some of it, thank goodness there are collectors, because a lot of it's been lost because I threw it away, because I couldn't store it. You know, and it's a real problem for sculptors. You know, what do you do? You've never got enough room, and if you make work, you know, you go, oh yeah, you know, you can't like it, you show it, and it doesn't sell, so you go, well, I think I'll just chuck it away, because, you know, I'm making the next thing. And one of the things about making work is that you really do operate in the zone of love. And central to my practice is this idea of love. And it doesn't look like that, but what it is that you try and do something, you try and hang an idea together, and there's all kinds of ways that you can express it. And you get there kind of, and then at the end you have to let it go, and you have to give it away, and if you don't, you can't make any more. So because, you know, it binds you up, it's sort of like an anal kind of thing. So, you know, you've got to be open and free to move on and to allow the growth that is happening in circuitous pathways that happen. And I've been making work for such a long time, like over 30 years, and I still feel incredibly unsure about what I'm doing. I know that sounds crazy, but that's what drives you, I think, and that's the thing that you that moves you from one thing to the next thing. You kind of know what you're after, and you pursue it. And of course, you know, the most amazing thing about sculpture is that as soon as you put your hand on it, it bites you, or it pushes you away, and you push it, and it pushes you. And sculpture is so much about that interaction between the material, the idea and the material, and you and the material, and all of the context of the material, the social, the space it's going, all of those things are pushing and pulling constantly with you. And so you really are just sort of negotiating a pathway to and guiding this thing to some sort of fruition. And really that's about the best I can describe how I work. Of course, then it depends upon huge numbers of people often, particularly the big works, which, because my body's completely falling apart, I can't lift things and I can't do things and I refuse to weld. So I've got to have people working with me, and I've got this wonderful network of people who work for me, with me, you know, I don't know how it all happens, but they just seem to have, we just work together in a beautiful kind of collaborative way. And really, at the end of the day, you know, I've got them to thank greatly, all my technicians, you know, and they've gone through my life all the time. And they are, you know, so precious to me because they offer their thoughts and advice and their work and their labour and their love and all of those things. And often, you know, they know just about as much about it as me. And so, you know, this idea that an artist is in a garret and starving to death, well, starving to death is quite true, but the garret is absolutely untrue. It's a totally social activity, particularly sculpture making. Painting's a little bit different. But you've got to have all of this around you. So it's a beautiful experience, in a sense, in the studio. The negotiation of work into the bigger zone, and I'm not going to mention the public because that's another contentious issue for me, particularly in Christchurch, but you're always having to negotiate, and central to everything in my work is negotiation. And sometimes it's a very positive negotiation, and other times not quite so. And you've got to learn to, once again, take it and push and pull with it, and in a sense, you know, when the blows hit you, you know, kind of learn to dodge them as much as possible, but you've really got to take it because that's what the material's telling you. So it's a beautiful enterprise as sculpture, probably the hardest enterprise. So where does it all come from? Well, I think it's deep, actually, and I don't quite know, but it's sort of almost behind your eye. And you don't really, you can't really see it. And sometimes you see it best when your eyes are shut or half shut. When they're blurred, you get the sense of something. It's a conscious and an unconscious activity. It requires disbelief, belief, and a huge amount of suspension. And I don't mean that just physically. I mean that metaphorically. You've got to have an idea of all of the elements of life, the blood, the skin, the bone, the nervous systems, the earth, the great earth, the waters, and all that connected to the winds and the clouds. And then a sense of understanding and bewilderment of the sun and the moon and the stars. All these things are surrounded together with play. Play, labour, and love is what happens. And out of that, then the work comes and is placed into the social. All this is encapsulated by this idea of time. And that's where I begin tonight. What I'm going to do tonight is show you really just one development of one idea, and see, and try and show you through that the kind of pushing and pulling that occurs during the development of a work. So what I've chosen, in fact, is this work starting here, but it's the one out in the foyer, which is the last piece I made for the show. So if we can just roll through the movie, please. And so this is a... I'm going to get him to roll it a few times so that you get a sense of what's happening here. It's just a computer model of an idea for a very, very big work, and it's sped up at the end where it's opening and closing. So the idea, what I was trying to come to, I was really interested the last few years in this idea of something that's there but not there, and the positive and the negative shadows that are created when you punch holes in things. Can we have that again? So we just do it again. Anyway, this was a proposal for a work in America, for a new building in America. And it was commissioned by the commissioner to develop the work to the point where it was realisable, and so that we could put a figure on how much it was going to cost. And then he killed it. And, you know, it was a huge disappointment because everyone had gone through and developed this amazing work, and we spent an awful lot of time and money, of course, trying to figure out how we were going to make it, how it was going to work, so that it never needed any maintenance, because I'm really keen on this idea that, you know, kinetic work, so often, you know, it falls apart, doesn't work, you know, and technology is actually there, it's just the skilled set of the artists often not there. So I'm really keen on, you know, changing that ground to make work that lasts for as long as possible, 100 years, you know, and it's working in 100 years' time. And that interests me. So this work was to do just that. Right. And I think the size of it was massive. It was 20 metres high and 10 metres across, or something close to that, and maybe 8 metres across or something. Massive. And it was going to cost, you know, like about $1.6 million to make it. Which seems like an awful lot of money, but in fact, actually, I think we looked at our profit margins on it and went, we're just going to be able to, we'll get there, but, you know, it's tricky. And so, you know, you take this huge risk. That client will say, well, how much is it going to cost? And you tell them, and then you go, well, I hope this is going to be true, because if you make a mistake and something doesn't work right, then all of a sudden, you're bankrupt. And, of course, you've got a contract and it's legally binding. Well, you know, you've got to do it. So this is the other part of sculpture making, particularly the scale of big things. You are running huge risks, and no one really understands that because there's only one of them. If you talk to Mr. Toyota, who makes, 20 million cars, well, of course they can spend a bit of money on development, but you spend on this a huge amount of development work. Okay, we can turn that off and we'll go to the next one. So we can just turn that off, Andrew, thank you. Okay, so anyway, this was an idea. So now we're going to go to this other idea when he turns this off. We can just turn that off, Andrew. Does he hear me, do you think, up there?
Maybe not.
Ah. Chunk. Right. Okay. Sweet. And this will come up in a second. Okay. So all of this started, actually, a few years ago when I was playing around in the studio one day with a bit of cardboard, and I'd nailed some holes in it, and I was sort of looking at some light and then holding it up and looking at some things projecting and then curving the bit of cardboard and going, well, you know, you can make curved shadows and all of these sorts of things. Yeah, it's really simple stuff. So often the things start from the very, very simplest ideas, and the layers of meaning and complexity, of course, come later. And I went, well, this is pretty cool. And then I took another bit of cardboard and held it in front, and I went, oh, it reminds me of this thing when I was a kid, of looking up into the trees and watching the branches move, and the branch, and you're getting this blurry light coming and falling upon you, and of course, you know, changing the way you saw things. And I thought, well, you know, how interesting, how simple and how interesting. And it was something that I'd worked on 30 years earlier and let go. And this is another thing, you know, nothing's straightforward. It's all kind of over the place, and it's my job to try and give it some form and some meaning or some sense. Anyway, so this is where it started. Now, I'm going to show you this. How do I turn that on? Is that going? Oh, it's going. Sweet. Okay. No, I don't want to go that way. I want to go there. Right, okay. So this is a work actually owned by the art gallery, not in the exhibition, because there's another bigger one out in the foyer. Well, sort of. It's different, but it has the place of the same ideas. And this was about reflection and shadows, and it's all it's about. It's about things crossing each other in an anti-clockwise direction. So it's opening and closing quietly, and it's reflecting light off the surface, and it's projecting light and shadow on the wall. And so you're just really playing with light, and it's just a thing. Anyway, I liked it a lot. I liked it even more when the art gallery bought it. I liked the money, actually. But one thing that didn't do was that when I'd finished it and I was in the studio and I was looking at it one night, I went, oh, I'd really like to get inside of this and see what happens. And, of course, you know, you have to be so careful because it'll chop your nose off if you get your nose too far. And I got, you know, and I got in and I went, oh my goodness, you know, it's going to chop me up. Well, it's not designed to do that. So I thought, well, wouldn't it be beautiful to make a work that actually went in both directions and there was only one motor? So the next day I started thinking a bit more about it, and lo and behold, I did lots and lots and lots of searching. There's no such motor. There's no motor in the world that goes in two directions at the same time. Well, I suppose, why would there be? Because it would be a motor that stands still. However, I went, well, I want a motor like this. And so out of that, and at the same time as the work that was in America, we were playing with this idea of counter-rotation. And so the motor actually came out of that. Right. How does it work? How does it happen? Well, quite simply, a meeting took place in my studio with coffee and my machinist and my technology friend who knows more about what's out there than me. And we sat down, and one of my technicians, and for an hour and a half we drank coffee and workshopped ideas about how you could make a motor that went in two directions at the same time. And after an hour and a half, we'd solved the problem. And it's so incredibly simple, it's ridiculous. And no one's ever done it. So what I'm about to show you is a kind of a computer drawing of how it works. And those black things, those two black lines, are in fact air muscles. And what happens is that you shove air in one end, and it expands. And as it expands, it shrinks in length. And, of course, that gives you a little bit of movement. And so if you do it push, 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 you get lots of movement. So we went away, and we sat down, and we worked out how to do this. And by using the muscles, very efficient, very strong, much stronger than a piston, and through cranks and little things called sprag clutches, it goes out to a wheel each side, and then there's an outer rim and an inner rim. Well, the outer rim goes clockwise and the inner rim goes anti-clockwise. It can't help but do that. So all we had to do then is transfer the inner ring to the top and the bottom ring to the bottom. The outside ring to the bottom. And there is counter-rotation. Brilliant. So, of course, by this stage, the job in America had been canned, and we'd developed this beautiful motor, and I'd bought enough materials to make one, but I had no money to make it. So for a year, it sat burning a big hole in my psyche and in my pockets, because I put lots of money into it, and I had nowhere to go, and I had this beautiful big pile of steel, which was rusting away, and so I had to work hard doing other jobs and other commissions so I could save enough to get my machinists to work on it and say, okay, let's do it, let's make it. So, once again, the old sculptor juggler metaphor is perfect because, none of my patrons would mind me saying this, I'm sure, but they give me some money to make it work and I rob out of that something to make things I want to make. And that is the way it works. And there ain't no other way it is going to work. So my patrons, who aren't here tonight, but once again, I thank greatly because they make the whole thing possible. So anyway, we got stuck into it and we started making... Oops, wrong way. We started making it. Now, doesn't really give you much sense of scale, but when you go out there you can see it. But the weight of it by the time we finished is 300 kilograms. So, she's a seriously bit of solid engineering. This is the beginning of the bits, putting the bits together. So there's about 6 months of machining and finishing the, doing the design, and then once the final drawings are done, signing them off, and then getting into the machine work. And, seeing them build up all these parts and buying bearings that you can't normally buy in New Zealand. We've used the top plate and the bottom plate. We've used things called cross-roller bearings, which are what they use for robots, where, the robot arm moves like this. Well, they can take massive loads in any dimension. Well, perfect for what we wanted. So, and we had to bring some bearings in at huge expense, but, we got did deals and, one does deals. It's always about deals. So here's just a... you've seen the drawing, and you can remember in the drawing, little armatures and things, and then where that post is at the end is where the wheel's going to go. Now, the wheel, we've had to make this work kind of so it stalls, or so it's not too powerful. Because when we did the calculations, we realised that, in fact, we'd made a motor that had 800 newton metres of torque, of driving torque, which is, if you don't really know, but it's like enough power to pull a ship out of the ocean. It's slow, it's not a fast motor, it's a very slow motor, but it's very powerful. So we had to make the driving wheels so that if anyone ever got near it, and it would stall because, it would just chop them apart. So we've cast these, we've had special wheels cast, so and they expand and lock onto the inner and outer drive rings. Why don't I get this right, Andrew? Okay. So here we are, you've seen the drawing, and here's the final article without the top plate on. And you can see the muscle, one on the right-hand side over there, is inflated, and it's shorter in length than the one that's uninflated. And so that's going to be driving these wheels, which aren't in there at the moment, but will be when we assemble it. So the most interesting thing to me is that my machinist, Stewie Mackay, is a very, very old school kind of machinist. He does drawings by hand, doesn't use any computer modelling, and he doesn't ever start anything until he knows it's going to work. So there's never anything left over, and there's no sort of attempts left in his backyard incomplete. So this it went from design to production, and that's it. And what is out the front is that motor there. So, here's some top rings and things like that, and here's the motor as we start to put it in. Right, I'm just going to pause a little bit here and go, right, so we've made this motor, and it's sitting in the studio. We didn't put one of it sitting in the studio, but for about 6 months it sat in the studio, and every night I would go into the studio and I'd turn on the compressor and I'd watch it. And I watched it and I watched it and I watched it, and I went, how could you make something that's so simple and yet so beautiful and yet totally useless? And I can't, you know, and I love the useless of it, actually, because I then went, well, I've made something that's never existed, and I can't think of, the only use it's got is for a sculpture of mine. It's got no other use. Well, anyway, over the nights of sitting there, I was playing with it, I got more and more excited, because I realised that, in fact, actually, that does have some uses. And I'm not going to go into it too much, because I don't want to give away any of my secrets, but to say that if it does work and do the things that we want it to do, that for the rest of my life, all of my work will be subsidised by the muscle motor. So this very simple thing will be the ultimate form of liberation. And, you know, for a sculptor, liberation is having all the resources in the world at your disposal so you can do anything you want instead of having to beg, borrow and steal. So anyway, we went along with this idea. Anyway, then I went, right, well, Jennifer, of course, was working on the show, and I had an old work, which is out there too, the sparking one, and I said, well, you know, wouldn't mind sticking that up again, you know. It's just sitting in the storage. So we fixed that up, and then I sort of, you know, nudge, nudge, wink, wink, as one does, you know, without being too pushy, say, well, you know, I'd really like to, you know, make this other work. So, of course, the gallery had, well, yes, yes, you can make it. But then, of course, I had to fund the damn thing, and that's hugely problematic once again. So, you know, what, you know, and I don't want to go on about it too much, but it is a constant issue. So anyway, Jennifer kindly, and the gallery staff kindly, put together an application to Creative New Zealand, and I did the budget, and I was totally honest and straight with them, and I said, I need $30,000 to complete it. What do they do? They give me half. So, you know, once again, oh, me dear, you know. Anyway, that doesn't stop me. I mean, I'd make it if they said no. I was still going to make it. But so what we've done is we've made the smallest possible thing we could out in the foyer that uses the motor so you can sort of get a sense of what it's going to do or what it's doing. So it's one of those works that kind of grows on you. It's not, doesn't tell you everything about itself very quickly, actually. It's kind of quiet, and you've got to spend a bit of time with it, and you've got to stand inside it and watch it and not fall over, and you just got to look at it, and it's about really nothing except light and shadow, and it moves very silently, of course, because it's a silent motor. So what we did was we went ahead and we made the structure that's out there in the studio, and you know, I'd never used aluminium before. I don't like aluminium particularly, but we could only afford to make it in aluminium. And anyway, the shroud, the covering, is in fact aluminium. You wouldn't believe it. Looks like something else, but it's actually electroplated aluminium made in America. And I found this amazing product. Architects use it quite a bit to make buildings look expensive. And I went, well, this looks suits me, you know. And so we bought in 20 sheets of this beautiful material, imported it into New Zealand, you know. And then we made the frame out of aluminium, and then we painted it, and then we sent the sheet off to get punched. Of course, you know, that in itself's a frightening experience. Sent it off and someone else punched, boom, 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 and you just hope that it's going to come back as you want it. And that was a bit fraught. However, we got there. So the process of putting it in was another issue. And once again, I'm going to just, you know, sprinkle great amounts of respect and gratitude from the gallery staff who, and Sean in particular, who went, no, that's not a problem, we'll just put it up there and we'll just get this man here and we'll just hang it up there and do it like that. And of course, it looks incredibly simple when you see it like it is now. But, you know, that, as I say, that the motor itself is 300 kilograms. And then you start adding it all together. I think it weighs nearly about 800 kilograms, the whole structure. It's quite safe. It's been engineered properly, so you can stand underneath it. So here it is, putting it together. And you can see that the frames, you know, have to be brought to the post. And up at the very top of the thing, and you'll see it in a minute, is a bearing which just slides, so it's just a free floating thing, so all the drive is coming from that disc structure, and you know, a motor that looks like a silver disc, and you can't really tell what it's doing. Now you can, because I've shown you, and if you dare copy it, if you could, but you won't be able to. So at the top, where here they are working way up in the air. And you can see that at the top where the arms come in, there's just a floating bearing, so it just slides around the shaft. So all the drive's coming from down below, and it just works away 24/7. And this is of course, you know, there's me standing like some kind of sergeant major at the edge, not having done anything except really just try and organise it. And here they are putting it up and struggling. And the beautiful thing is, it went together and there wasn't one bolt that didn't fit. So once again, thank you to my machinist and engineer, Stewie Mackay. And there it is in its final place. So there it is. So really, that's all I want to talk about. You're more than welcome to ask me questions about anything you want to. Well, up to a point. And I'll try and answer them.
Well, what was one of your earliest sculptural works that you had to really scrounge materials for?
Every single one. I mean, if you go into the exhibition, you'll see, the King and Queen, the branches were nipped out of a big willow tree on the banks of one of the rivers in Otago, I'm not telling you, on private property in the middle of the night. So it started there, but it started before that. And the slate was all the slate in the show, it's all broken or old roof slates, which were thrown away in a scrapyard. And I just recycled the good ones. And when we were putting the show together, actually, I can't remember what gallery it was. I shan't say the gallery's name. But anyway, one of them was broken, and we had to fix it. And I wasn't allowed to really touch it because, you know, it's not owned by me now. And they said, well, you know, they're very precious. Where did they come from? Well, they're old roof slates, actually, and they come from Wales. Well, you can replace it, but it's got to come from the same geographical location. So I did. I went down to the building place downtown and found an old roof slate, which, of course, all roof slates come from, well, until recently, came from Wales. So beg, borrow and steal materials has been a constant right through the whole of my production, actually.
Andrew. You talk about making sculpture in quite a simple way, in a sense. You know, the idea of closing your eyes and things happening out of simple ideas and devices and playing one thing and another.
Yeah.
Clearly making the works much more complex than that.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, the works are made, and you said right at the beginning that the people who write about the work, the essays in the book, frightened you, surprised you, whatever, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So do you want to talk about how you respond to works way after the event, when you had other people's responses, and how that moderates what happens after that, and one thing or another?
Gosh, that's a big question. Well, first of all, I must say, I don't actually take much notice of other people's opinions, and never have, but I do like hearing them. And that answers that part, doesn't it? I mean, you know, one has an idea about what is one's trying to do. That's no question of that. You know, it's not sort of, you know, you don't have an idea, you do. The way you get to that realisation and the finish of it is incredibly circuitous, I think, is the best way to say. You never go straight to the resolution. Or actually, occasionally, you might. And it's so lucky that you get such a damn fright, you go, oh, and I can't be right. Because it's too easy, you know, when it's so hard often, and things like that. So I guess the point is that you do have an idea and you do work towards it. And maybe you do listen to other people. But at the end of the day, I think you've got to listen to yourself and you've got to be true to yourself. You know, you can't be taught this. I think it's in you. And I think this idea that, you know, and I'm not trying to be anti-intellectual here, but you can teach a person the aspects of how art's made, but you can't make an artist, I don't think. You can help guide them. And I taught for years, and of course you do too, Simon, and we kind of know that, you know, you can teach people lots of things, but you can't make them an artist. You know, they've got to make themselves an artist. Am I answering the question, or am I avoiding what you want?
No, you're not avoiding.
So what else would you like me to say? I mean, to talk about?
Well, I mean, when you work, you know, and you look, I mean, you're looking at a survey show of what you work, and I know that you found work that you thought existed, and when work went up, it looked different to what you probably imagined, or what your memories were, you know?
Yes.
In terms of size, how it related to what was around it at the same period and after that.
Yes.
So your journey shifts and changes.
Yes.
It's not a linear, you know, it's an incredibly dynamic journey, isn't it?
I think it is.
And I'm just wondering how you respond to events around the work that actually channel the work. And so, for instance, your next body of work, I know you don't know what it's going to be, but is this exhibition, for instance, going to have an effect on when you practice over the next 12 months?
Right, that's a good question. One of the great frightening things, first of all, and one day Jennifer took me back through the show, and I'd been sort of, you know, trying to be staunch, you know, put it up, you know. And we went back, and she'd written some wall text, and I read it, and I looked at some of the work, and I just burst into tears, you know. And I went, oh, my goodness me, you know, is this going to be what it's like for the next 3 weeks? I can't handle it, you know, because it's just so overwhelming, you know. And it is, because you've done it, and you're looking back, and you're going, goodness me, you know, I've done all this stuff, and it's heavens, I don't know what to say about it, except that the time, and still, I when I made it, I loved what I did, and funnily enough, you know, I went back and looked at it, and there was not one work I didn't like. Oh, actually, there was one work I didn't like, and it was The Slate Room, and it was one of my all-time favourite works, and I couldn't figure out why I didn't like it anymore. And I kept going back, and like over 3 days, and I went, I just can't get it, I don't get it. And of course, when I'd made it originally, you were above it, you were upstairs looking down onto it, and of course you were on ground level. And it was too tall up the wall. So I said to the technicians, oh, we're going to cut all the legs and make it lower. And we did, and I liked it again. And I went, whew, that's good. You know. So I think the instinct of work is that you do actually, you know, get to a point where you do kind of like it, although you don't always know quite why, and sometimes you're not sure about it. And I think that's definitely something that happens with me. And doing a show like this, it forces you to go back and sort of revise your attitudes and to reassess where you've come from and why you're doing it. And it's frightening and overwhelming. And then you've got to go back to the studio, which is completely empty and very white because we painted it, and go, well, now I've got to start again. And that's frightening. And I think, you know, you've got to be brave. And I think the braveness of making art, and I think it is a very, very, I think it is a brave enterprise. I think you've got to be very brave. You've got to be even braver when you've had a survey show, because you've got to kind of make, you've got to make better. You know, it's got to be better than what you've just done. Otherwise, there's no point, probably. I'm kind of nervous about that, actually, I must say. But I've always liked it being in a difficult place. I don't like comfort. I mean, I don't, actually. It's funny, isn't it? I mean, I like a comfortable chair occasionally, but that's about it. And I like bed being comfortable, but, you know, I don't like... I don't want it too easy. Oh, goodness. So I've put, you know, Jennifer's made this happen and the gallery's put it on, and now I'm going to have to be uncomfortable again. Thank you.
Andrew, I was just wondering about, like, you've talked about this technical part, but at the beginning you were talking about, you know, when I was looking at your work, it's very kind of, it feels like there's a lot of meaningfulness in it, a bit of a passion,
yes,
and connectedness.
Yes.
And you were talking about knowing about the body and knowing about the land.
Yes.
And it feels very, you know, very meaningful, very kind of respectful. And So I guess I was just wondering about in your earlier days, where that knowing about the body and knowing about the land and then wanting to reflect that into your work, because it's very... in everything that you do, body and the land, is reflected through it.
Mm.
Where does that come from?
Good question. I think playing on the Manawatu riverbank when I was 7 and 8 with a little bulldozer and a spade, and making roads and watching the willow trees and the leaves, being taught about... you know, how things come, and being prepared to be alone. And I think the enterprise is extraordinarily lonely, and I think loneliness is something that's really important, because, you know, I kept saying we have a big team, but in fact, actually, you know, this is a very lonely place. And all of those things, and then, of course, you know, very good education, you know, this idea that the earth is something that we have to respect, and all those sorts of things, you know, all sort of coming together, you know, definitely no question of that. That's very, very much a driving force. And then, you know, lots of reading. You know, I can't stress the importance of that enough, actually. Of soaking up as much information as possible right from an early age. By the time, I was so lucky because my dad was very ill as a teenager, and I, of course, went off the rails big time and got rescued by this lovely couple who were academics, and they just fed me books, you know, read that. And, of course, you know, it stimulated my imagination and my knowledge and all of that. So... all I can say is that I've been incredibly lucky that I've had beautiful guidance all my life until I was let go. And yet always a bit naughty, probably. Mischievous, inquisitive, all those things. Mm. Does that help?
I was wondering, you know, you were saying that you've got a team of people that you work with. And so did that happen only once you started your kinetic works, or from the very beginning when you were doing other works, did you still have that, or were you working by yourself at that point?
Good question. Right at the very beginning, when I was doing performance work, which isn't in the exhibition, of course, I was just working by myself. And then very early on, I mean, I would still do all of my work myself, but I'd always have people helping me. You know, like I'd have, and when I made the binoculars for the vein, the man ground the lenses. I thought I was mad, but anyway, he did. So, you know, I had those technicians. I had a glass technician stitching things together. The neon man making things out of neon. So, yeah, always, it's a social activity, enterprise. As it's gone on, and my interests have become wider and more technical, of course, there are more people involved. And, of course, you know, now when you do big things outdoors, you've got to have engineers and structural engineers, and you've got to have, you know, permits, and you've got to have, you know, bureaucrats running around trying to, you know, you're trying to dodge them. And a lot of people, and you've got to keep your focus and at the same time be very, very generous and giving. So it's been an interesting thing, and I think, I'm really glad that my work has gone the way it has. It started off being quite singular in terms of its, enterprise, and it's got to be more demanding of other people. I still, though, love being silent in my studio and just working by myself. So that's a little treasure that I keep, and I don't show anyone or tell anyone when I'm doing it. I just go away and do it. Yeah, so there's a whole lot of stuff, yeah. Yeah.
So are the works fully conceived before you start making them?
Right, that's another good question. Well, a work like this, it is kind of conceived pretty fully because it costs a lot to make. And sometimes you get disappointed because it's, you know, you've modelled it and you go, well, you see the model and you look at the finished result and you go, well, what's different? You know, except the scale and the real thing. Certainly the more technical works do require pre-thinking. And so that's hence why I talk about the quiet part in the studio where I do my own thing, where I've got more control about it so I can... in a sense, fail. And, I can't stress enough the idea of failure. You know, that you must fail. You know, failure is something that we all go, oh, goodness, you know, can't go on to university because he's failed. So, you know, you just do it again so you don't fail. And so, you know, the idea of renewal and constantly renewal is very important. So, yes, sometimes a work like that is, there's no, the only discovery is when you've finished it and you put it up and go, right, thank you, next one, you know.
Could you explain what you were doing in the video that's showing before you there, where you seem to be getting up and down to a dead owl, is it?
Right. Oh, right. Well, that's very, very, very early work. And I was having a conversation with an owl. Yes. Oh, it did. It went on for an awful long time. The owl would never talk back properly. It was really an attempt to try and play with an idea which is about you and the alter ego, I think, probably, you know, and the animal kind of relationship. And, you know, in the early, early days when I was doing my performance-based work, I was really trying to find out all the stuff about, who I was and why I was doing it and things like that. So it was kind of formulative. Funnily enough, 30 years later, it's been found again. It is a bit mysterious, isn't it? Yeah, okay, thank you. Yeah, it did go on for a bit. Yes, you're right. But I had scripted a conversation. Yes. That's all right.
I've got two questions, Andrew. One's an easy one, and one I'm not even quite sure how to articulate. The
right.
easy one
mm-hmm.
is what's going to happen to that next. Is it going somewhere?
Is that an easy question? Right. well, it's going to hang there for a while, and I'm going to forget about it, and I don't know. But there are all kinds of plans for it to go away somewhere else. And it may. And it might end up back at the studio. I hope it doesn't, because I don't know where I'm going to put it. So I'd like to sell it, actually. That would be the best thing to say. Hope.
The other question is, in your introduction you mentioned not mentioning the public. Is there something about the public that is difficult?
Well, you know, that's a good question, because yes, actually, you know, right from the very start, when I was doing my early work, I got into trouble for doing it. For some reason, people didn't like it, or they got offended, or, you know, things like that. And you know, I went, well, I'm still going to do it. They're not going to stop me. And so I did a lot of my performance work, in a sense, private, in private space, and then relayed it through closed-circuit TV to the public. So it was sort of hands-off. And then years later, I was living in Auckland, I think, and a different kind of thing, but the same thing happened. And I went, oh, God, you know, get a grip. Why can't people be a bit more giving, you know? And the crucifixion in Christchurch, you know, was the beginning of that kind of antagonism, I think, you know. And I just went, well, I don't think the public's disingenuous at all. I just think that, you know, we live in a kind of social construct where the media beats up things and, you know, people with, you know, minor opinions get major views. And that seems to predominate the debate, you know, not informed debate, actually misinformed debate. And, of course, you know, some years later, it happened again in Christchurch. God, Christchurch, you know, over that bridge. And, you know, once again, misinformation. And so, you know, part of my attitude is I just don't know how to deal with it. I never have a problem with clients. You know, they go, we'd like one of your works, and you go, well, this is what I'd like to do, and they go, right, start tomorrow, and you go, how easy is that? I think I'd rather work for them. And, you know, I think my opinion about the notion of public art has certainly become fairly intransigent, and I don't like that. I don't like the fact that I don't really want to do anything. But I sort of kind of gone, well, how many times do you want to get kicked, you know? And I think it's actually a problem in New Zealand, I'm, you know, but I shouldn't say that, but seems to be. And I think, you know, I mean, we've just been through another debate about, you know, a building on the Arts Centre. You know, it was a dumb idea, and it was a dumb building. And it was placed in a dumb place. But somehow it kept getting pushed. And it took a huge amount of debate for it to be considered properly. And it's not going to happen. You know, there's a tradition of this in Christchurch. So to answer the question is that I'm not against the notion of the public. I love it. I'd love to be able to do it. I've done it in Wellington. And it's not really been any problems, except for vandals, you know. But that was easy. But here, for some reason, not so, more difficult. So, does that answer it? Kind of. I don't really want to put my foot in it. I've done that enough.
Good.
There is
one more question. if I could just say.
Yes.
There is a piece of public sculpture is difficult.
That's
the
right.
The whole world knows that.
Mm.
But there is one piece of sculpture which I find on the riverbank by the law building, by a very structured, minimalist, and rather good piece of architecture. And there's that piece of white stone standing up and seeming to slip off. Do you know the one?
Mm-hmm.
It stands there by...
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, there is about that a hugely sort of... It talks to you powerfully about the whole problem about the law and the agony of waiting.
Yeah.
Who's responsible for everything.
Yeah.
So it seems to me, I wondered what you thought about that as a piece of public work which does seem to talk.
Well, it does. It doesn't really interest me, actually. But to be frank, very little does actually interest me in terms of public art in Christchurch, I must say. I mean, I think it's very facile and superficial. However, that's why I didn't want to say too much.